The following episode of K-Voice was recorded March 20th, 2017 at 7:06 p.m. Enjoy the show.
Stop the obstruction and resistance, and that's what they have. In fact, they have a sign, resist, resist. They want to resist everything.
Hello, thank you for listening to my show, K-Voice. That is the letter K, voice, a voice of the resistance. I'm Kelly. Let's get right into it. On Tuesday, they are voting on H.R. 372. Do you believe insurance companies should be subject to federal antitrust laws? Should they be allowed to form monopolies and collude to raise prices? No. Good news is, on this one, it is a Republican, Paul Gosar of Arizona, who is sponsoring the bill, so there is a good chance the Republicans may vote correctly. There are many things up for vote, but the main news coming out of Congress this week is from dueling hearings. Does anyone think it a crazy coincidence that the hearing for our new Supreme Court pick, Neil Gorsuch, and the FBI Russia hearing was scheduled on the same day, Monday? I don't think so. Don't let the resistance to the far-right Scalian Supreme Court seat-stealing, Neil, the taking of human life by private persons is always wrong, Gorsuch, fade amongst the noise of the Russian connection. The real questioning of Gorsuch will begin Tuesday, and Gorsuch is expected to be the most prepared nominee ever. But, reportedly, so are the Democrats. And if Monday is prologue, they will be tough on him. After committee, the nomination goes to Congress, and that is where the Democrats will have the chance to step up and use the filibuster tactic. Let's talk about who is behind the Gorsuch nomination. Gorsuch was chosen from a list compiled by the Heritage Foundation. The list only included judges who were pro-life. The Heritage Foundation, according to Wikipedia, is an American think tank based in Washington, D.C. The foundation took a leading role in the conservative movement during the presidency of Ronald Reagan, whose policies were taken from the Heritage Policy Study Mandate for Leadership. Heritage has since continued to have significant influence in U.S. policymaking and is considered to be one of the most influential conservative research organizations in the United States. After the 2016 election of 45 as U.S. president, Heritage played a major role in shaping his transition team. The fact is, Heritage is so far to the right that many Republicans have publicly complained about its extremism. According to Right Wing Watch, Heritage, led by former South Carolina Senator Jim DeMint, has played a major role in the Trump administration, especially on staffing and policy ideas. Conservative activist Marjorie Dannenfelser called Heritage the fulcrum of Trump's administration. And one source told Politico's Katie Gluick that Heritage launched a shadowed transition team to expand on Heritage fearless leader Jim DeMint. DeMint, who left the Senate in 2013 to lead Heritage, was one of Congress's most radical members and the primary conduit through which the religious rights agenda makes its way into the halls of Congress. This is from Right Wing Watch. If you are not familiar with Right Wing Watch, I highly recommend them. He said that gay people and unmarried women who have premarital sex should not be allowed to teach in public schools, and led the unsuccessful drive to defeat hate crimes bill because it protected people based on sexual orientation, gender, and gender identity, falsely claiming that it would criminalize free speech and land pastors in jail. Even before DeMint took the reins, Heritage had taken anti-LGBT stances, criticizing the Supreme Court ruling that knocked down bans on gay sex. DeMint has denounced immigration reform, universal health care, and abortion rights, which he said should be banned, even in cases of rape or incest. Heritage also taxed his analyst, Jason Ritchie, with studying the supposed negative effects of immigration reform. Previously, Ritchie wrote articles for white nationalists, Richard Spencer's racist alt-right website linking Latinos to crime, and authored a doctoral dissertation claiming that Latinos have a genetically inferior IQ to white people, and that the children and grandchildren of Latino immigrants will persist in having low IQs, dragging down American society unless the U.S. adopted a more discriminating immigration policy. The group has also tried to put an academic face on climate change and climate change denial, and emerged as one of the driving forces promoting the false claim that U.S. elections are riddled with widespread voter fraud. And DeMint even admitted that Heritage is promoting voter restriction laws, quote, all over the country, because in states where they do have voter ID laws, you've seen, actually, elections begin to change toward more conservative candidates. Unquote. Heritage is now aiming to bring its political agenda, viewed as radical and extreme even by most Republicans, to the Supreme Court. No matter how well Gorsuch presents himself, always keep in mind where his support is coming from. The foundation does their research. They would not put a judge up for nomination if he was not exactly what they wanted in place to enact their extremist agenda. Okay, across the way was the FBI hearing. It was like watching two different hearings. The left was having a hearing about Russia, and the traitorous right was having a hearing about the leakers and publishers of knowledge. House quote-unquote Intelligence Committee Chair Representative Devin Nunes, Republican of California, suggested to FBI Director James Comey that his bureau should also look into possible collusion between Russian officials and, drumroll please, Hillary Clinton. And Trey Gowdy from Slytherin House even went so far as to suggest leakers and distributors of leaked information be prosecuted. He hinted at 10-year felony prosecutions. We may find ourselves in the resistance needed to fight for more free and open media. Moreover, we must continue to fight vigorously for an independent committee to investigate and get to the bottom of the Russian connection. The FBI hearing was a farce of grandstanding and partisan politics, clouding the importance of one of the greatest attacks on American soil by a hostile foreign entity since 9/11. Continue your chosen form of resistance, letter writing, marching, town hall questions, phone calls, what have you. This is too important to glaze over in left versus right mess. Not that the Supreme Court nomination and the Russian hearings isn't enough to think about. Let's touch base on last week's budget rollout. A budget which was highly influenced by the Heritage Foundation proposes cuts to many programs. The total cost per year, per American, for 17 of the programs said to be on the chopping block is $22.36 per year, of which more than a third comes from a single clean energy program. By contrast, housing subsidies like mortgage interest deduction, which are disproportionately used by the wealthy, cost $296.29 per American. This was going around the internets, and it pretty much says it all for me. Take my $1.37. I want my PBS. Take my 46 cents. I'm all for the funding of art programs. Take my 46 cents. I love my museums, colleges, and libraries. Take my 11 cents. I support developing minority businesses. 66 cents. I am for entrepreneurship and innovation. $1.60. I want us to export more goods overseas. 43 cents. I would like to see more American manufacturing. 88 cents. I think community policing needs vast improvement. $1.48. I support programs for women. $1.55. I believe in due processes for all. 48 cents. We need a civil rights division in the Justice Department. 38 cents. I think we need to defend our Mother Earth. 3 cents. I know more work needs to be done for climate change. $8.95 because we need more sustainable energy, and $2.71 because we should reduce our carbon footprint. By saving these programs means I'm out $22.36 a year, I'm good. Now give me back the $575 I pay to keep the war machine running. And the $368 I pay in corporate welfare to Big Oil and Walmart. Included in the harm the loss of these programs could cause is the fiscal harm they could do. For example, Meals on Wheels. The annual meal cost of Meals on Wheels is roughly the equivalent of one day in the hospital annually. The meal cost is $2,765 for 250 days, while the cost of one day in the hospital is around $2,271. According to the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation. What happens when seniors go malnourished? They go to the hospital. And what happens when children go malnourished, besides trips to the doctor? Mick Mulvaney, the disgusting, literally takes the food from the mouths of babes budget director, had this to say about feeding financially disadvantaged children.
After school programs generally they're supposed to be educational programs, right? And that's what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to help kids who can't, who don't get fed at home, get fed so they do better in school. Guess what? There's no demonstrable evidence they're actually doing that. There's no demonstrable evidence they're actually helping results, helping kids do better in school.
What do you say we don't feed Mulvaney for a week and see how his performance as budget director is? The School Nutrition Association, SNA. It is the largest professional organization for school lunch providers in the county. It has 55,000 members. And the SNA offers a fact sheet. It has statistics of the current state of the National School Lunch Program. Through the program, nearly 100,000 schools and institutions serve lunches each day. Of the total 30 million students served, 2 million are receiving free lunches, 5 million are receiving reduced-priced lunches, and 7 million pay full price. These are according to their families' incomes. For years, scientists have been studying the effect of nutrition on student performance. In 2008, a Journal of School Health Study discovered that fifth graders eating fast food scored worst on standardized tests and literacy assessments. A follow-up study of fifth graders published in the Journal of Educational Research in 2012 linked eating fast food to declining math and reading scores. A study was done in 2008, a Journal of School Health Study that discovered there are several direct effects that involve the immediate impact of nutrition on the daily performance of a student. Mental and behavioral problems can be tracked back to unhealthy nutrition and poor eating habits. Nutritional deficiencies with zinc, vitamin B vitamins, and omega-3 fatty acids and proteins have been shown to affect the cognitive development of children. There is also evidence to suggest that diets high in amounts of trans fats and saturated fats have a negative impact on cognition. This will harm the ability of students to learn at a place necessary for school success. Scientists have also established a link between student behavior and nutrition. Access to proper nutrition can help students maintain psychosocial well-being and reduce aggression. This can be a positive effect on a student by avoiding discipline and suspension. The indirect effects of poor nutrition can be severely detrimental to the performance of students over time. Students with unhealthy lifestyles are more likely to become sick. These illnesses have had an effect on the amount of class time missed. By not attending classes, students are much more likely to fall behind, and when they are in class, they are more likely to have less energy and have concentration issues. This data points towards one of the major issues with school lunches in America. If 19.2 million students are receiving free lunches due to their socioeconomic status, school lunch could be their only opportunity for a nutritious meal each day. The National School Lunch Program costs the country $12.65 billion. Almost all of this money comes from the federal government. So let's do the math. If kids eat, they perform better in school. If they perform better in school, they become more productive members of society. Productive members of society benefit the economy and don't become dependent on the system. Thereby, investment in giving kids food is an investment in our collective future. So, let's talk about what happens next with the budget. There's no use in getting too stressed out about it yet, although I'm one to talk. Because next, the budget goes to Congress. Different congressional committees in both the House and the Senate will hold hearings on proposed budgets for departments within their jurisdictions. Proposed cuts are expected to draw opposition from members from both political parties. USA Today explains, the Republicans will draw 13 separate spending bills funding various agencies of the government. But it has been decades since Congress has been able to complete this process. Generally, it breaks down in summer, and lawmakers end up passing one giant spending bill sometime near the end of the calendar year. What about the White House? It is preparing more budget plans. Thursday's proposal was what aides like to call a skinny budget, focusing on discretionary spending with very little detail. A fuller budget proposal in May will include tax policy and spending on entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare. So, prepare ourselves for that one. Will the Trump plan pass Congress? USA Today says no. And that's not unusual. Congress uses the president's budget as a starting point for writing its own bills. Since Republicans control the House, the Senate, and the White House, there's a better chance that this year the final bill will look something like the president's outline than there is in times when the White House and Congress are held by different parties. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York signaled that Democrats would fight the proposal tooth and nail. He said, the very programs that help the middle class the most most are those that get clobbered the hardest. Investments in infrastructure, education, scientific research that leads to cures for diseases, all take big hits, Schumer said. Democrats in Congress will emphatically oppose these cuts. Unquote. While the White House spending plan would fund the government for fiscal year 2018, which begins October 1st of this year, in theory, lawmakers in Congress face a deadline of September 30th to pass the appropriations bills to fund various federal agencies and programs. But if that process breaks down as usual, it may be the end of the year before any of the changes 45 actually once begin to take effect. So we have some time. Meanwhile, the White House has offered a supplemental budget request that would boost defense spending by $30 billion for the rest of 2017 and an additional $3 billion for immigration enforcement and border security. That bill will be taken up separately by Congress, presumably in the next few weeks. Hear that? That is the sound of true fortitude in the resistance. Last week, hundreds of Wisconsinites upset about Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House's health care plan, braved 20-degree weather and heavy snow to show up and tell him to kill his terrible, no-good plan to give people access to more expensive health care. Rest assured that the resistance does not lack in strength. Just to cheer you up, 45's approval rating is going down. Only 37% of respondents approve of the job the president is doing, compared to 58% who disapprove. Fight the power. Resistance comes in many forms. There's a digital resistance campaign that launched Thursday. Our oh-so-respectable president appears to feel pretty comfortable on Twitter, where he speaks unfiltered to a platform of millions. But this group of anonymous activists has plans to fight Trump by hitting him where it hurts. His follower count. Block the Bully. Block the Bully allows users to plug in their Twitter account, and it, with one click, automatically unfollows our president at real Donald Trump handle for them and blocks his account. And if users don't already follow Trump, it will follow and then unfollow him so he still gets the notification. Go to blockthebully.com. You don't have to sign up for anything. Simply hit the button and it will work for you. One of the project's leaders said, Trump is using Twitter as his bully puppet. And I think that everybody knows that. We realize that this is Trump's own direct-to-consumer channel that he feels empowered by and he controls. So the goal, the organizer said, was to launch an agitation campaign against Trump by targeting his Twitter following. He said, we know what a thin skin he has and that he reacts to everything. If we could get a vast number of people to unfollow and then block him in the channel that he values most, I think it sends a very strong statement. So many smart people are on our side. Okay, local votes matter. The first anti-LGBTQ law of the year has been passed. And the winner of the race is South Dakota. SB 149 was passed by the Senate Health and Human Services Committee last week. And on Wednesday last week, passed by the full Senate. The bill legalizes discrimination by adoption agencies based on religious grounds. Vote locally. Local elections have consequences. The following story is a story of resistance from a Mighty Girls Facebook page, which aims at inspiring the next generation of history makers. On October 24, 1975, in a remarkable display of solidarity and determination, Iceland's women went on strike for equal rights. They refused to go to their jobs, do their housework, or perform childcare, all to show the importance of women in their society. Incredibly, 90% of women in Iceland partook in the strike. Of those, 25,000 women, almost 12% of Iceland's population at the time, took to the streets of Reykjavik in a demonstration, while other protests were held in towns across the county. The historic strike was called Women's Day Off, and it's gone down in Icelandic history as the beginning of a dramatic change in the status of women and the first step towards Iceland becoming the world's most feminist country. Although the right of Icelandic women to vote was recognized in 1915, by 1975, there were still only 3 sitting female members of parliament, less than 5%. Across the country, women faced discrimination at work, including lower pay and fewer jobs. job opportunities. The progress being made in other Nordic countries, where women held 16-23% of parliamentary seats and had more recourse against discrimination, was frustrating women's rights activists in Iceland. A woman's group called the Red Stockings was the first to propose the strike after the event was renamed Women's Day Off, and framed it in such a way to show the many ways Icelandic women contributed to the country. It secured near universal support. When the day of protest came, many companies were forced to close for a day. Schools and daycares kept the doors shut. Fathers ended up taking their children to work, and easy-to-prepare foods like sausages were sold out in many grocery stores. Meanwhile, women took to the streets to listen to speeches and discussed how they could improve their situation. The majority of men were supportive of their effort. Steinmar Gunnarsson, who was a co-editor of the conservative paper Morgenbladet at the time, said, "I do not think I've ever supported a strike, but I do not see this action as a strike. It was a demand for equal rights. It was a positive event." He added, "Probably most people underestimated this day's impact at the time. Later, both men and women began to realize that it was a watershed." Unquote. Forgive my pronunciation coming up here, but Vidigis Finnborgadottir says her life was particularly changed by the Women's Day Off. She would go on to become Europe's first female president in 1980, a move she insists could not have happened without the protest. She says, "What happened that day was a first step in women's emancipation in Iceland." She explained, "It completely paralyzed the country and opened the eyes of many men. Things went back to normal the next day, but with the knowledge that women are as well as men pillars of society. So many institutions came to a halt, it showed the force and necessity of women. It completely changed the way of thinking." Unquote. The impact of the changes that this show of power by women helped foster are obvious. In Iceland today, women now hold 41% of the seats in parliament, and the country has been ranked number one in the world for gender equality by World Economic Forum for 7 years in a row. For her part, the president, who served as Iceland's president for 16 years, will always look back with fondness at this historic day when women stood together. Quote, "There's a tremendous power in it all. Great feeling of solidarity and strength among all those standing on the square in the sunshine." Unquote. Many of us have been accused of being too emotional lately, told to stop being so dramatic, to calm down, or something like, "Wow, you seem really emotional about this. Does that sound familiar?" Or perhaps those are things we have said, or said things like it. What we are doing when we say that? Well, we might think we're helping by making the conversation more comfortable. It is called tone policing. It attacks the emotions behind the argument rather than the argument itself. Besides it being a weak argument or a debate tactic, it is patronizing and dismissive. It comes from a place of privilege. It is, by and large, a tactic used by white American-born straight people who, since the election, have been going around telling people to calm down and not overreact to 45's election. Those that feel that way tend to not be from a targeted minority group. They don't stand to lose much, regardless of how this presidency is ran. But regardless of the argument, if the argument is on the right or the left, make a practice of targeting the facts of the argument rather than the person or their feelings. Our feelings are real, and no one gets to dictate the terms of our fear or the emotional life we infuse in our activism. Nor does anyone get to criticize how we talk about our experiences. I have posted a great cartoon explaining tone policing on my Facebook page at K Voice of Resistance. Check out my page, like it, and share it if you think it's of help. To finish today, I'm going to read straight from John Pavlovitz's blog, Stuff That Needs to Be Said, because it expressed how I, and I know many of us, have been feeling. I am not sharing it as a means to be unnecessarily mean and rude to supporters of 45 or those who have voted, but more as a means to provide some personal comfort if you too have been feeling a little more out of sorts since the election. 62 million reasons I'm not the same anymore. Some people tell me that I have changed, that I've become more confrontational and irritable, that I'm less tolerant of disagreement now. They say I seem angrier and I'm more political. They tell me that I'm not the gentle, loving soul I once was, and they regularly click their tongues against the roof of their mouths in judgment, lamenting the person they say I used to be. I could argue with their assessment, but in the interest of time, I'll just go ahead and concede. In fact, I'll tell them precisely when the change they sense actually began. It began when 62 million people in this country voted for a man who spoke these words to be our president. I moved on her, actually. You know, she was down on Palm Beach. I moved on her. And I failed. I'll admit it. I did try to fuck her. And she was married. I moved on her very heavily. In fact, I took her out furniture shopping. She wanted to get some furniture. I said, I'll show you where they have some nice furniture. I took her out for furniture. I moved on her like a bitch, but I couldn't get there. She was married. Then all of a sudden, I see her. She's now got the big bony tits and everything. She's totally changed her look. Yeah, that's her with the gold. I better use some Tic Tacs just so I can start kissing her. You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. And like, it's like a magnet. Just a kiss. I don't even wait. And then you're a star. And they let you do it. You can do anything. Grab them by the pussy. You can do anything. There are plenty of moments before and since, of course. But looking back, this was a pivot point. One that changed me irrevocably. It made me feel estranged around the people I used to feel at home with, and it derailed my hope that decency would prevail. In so many ways, this was the moment of my emancipation from feeling obligated to make nice with them, because despite his woefully malignant words and everything they pointed to his character, his predatory behavior, his misogyny, his indecency, and his infidelity, his disregard for the humanity of women, 62 million adults, many of them professed Christians, essentially said, "This is my guy." And if you were among those who said it, you can justify it, or rationalize it away, or spin it any way you want, and I'll politely but unapologetically tell you that you are full of it. You compile every real or imagined boogeyman in front of me as reasonable defense, but at the end of the day, you elevated a man who said these words and was guilty of this behavior to the highest office in our country, awarding him the greatest power that is solely on you. I will not share the blame with you by my silence. As for me, I know who I am and what I stand for, and I could never be this. So confrontational or not, irritable or not, less tolerant or not, angry or not, political or not, this is who I am now. I can sleep at night knowing I didn't co-sign this. I'm still not okay with it, and honestly, I'm not okay with those who are okay with it. And regardless of how confrontational it may make some people, I'm fully comfortable with my holy discontent right now, and so all the tone policing and shame throwing and wrist slapping in the world isn't going to deter me or silence me or move me from this path of most resistance. He said what he said. He was rewarded despite having said it, and I have been fundamentally altered, and there's nothing I can do about it now but speak the words that I feel called to speak. So yes, I suppose I have changed. And there are about 62 million reasons why. I'd have preferred not to have witnessed these days at all, or feel this way about so many people I live with or alongside. I'd have preferred that so many of my Christian brothers and sisters didn't elevate such malevolence. I'd preferred to be the same person that I used to be, but that's not going to happen. That was John Pavlovitz. I started this podcast because I knew I was compelled to speak, and I was going to speak my words unapologetically, and I was going to stand up for all I saw wrong so I could recover some hope for this America, and I'm not going to let 62 million votes or one man deter me from the path of what I know is right and what I know is good. And I thank you for resisting in any way and every way you do every day. Thank you for listening to the Tuesday edition of my show, K-Voice of Resistance. I'll be back with a new one on Friday, streaming live at 4 p.m. on crabdiving.com. Also available for download on your preferred podcasting app. Follow me on Twitter at Kelly the Voice and on Facebook at K-Voice of Resistance. If you could, shoot me a message should you hear of any resistance news or are partaking in an act of resistance yourself. I would love to hear your stories. Take care of yourself out there, and as always, resist.